across the galaxy and into your dwelling. It's the Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast that explores every corner of the Star Wars universe.
Sweet mother Talzin, my head is killing me.
That makes sense. I mean, you took quite a beating back on Dagobah. Dude, I'm glad you're up and at it.
Oof, barely. Wait, what? What happened? I don't even know how we got off that slimy mud hole of a planet. Last thing I remember is I was just, what, it was a big old tree?
I mean, to be honest, you did get sideswiped by that. CB, what did you say that thing was called?
A dragon snake.
Yeah, that dragon snake. It threw you across the swamp and smashed your noggin real good on that tree.
Then what happened?
Well, you were out cold, so I knew I had to rise to the occasion. I focused myself and reached out within the forest. I lifted the dragon snake out of the water, and as it writhed in the air, I connected with the beast, feeling its primal instincts and fear, and dude, I calmed it. It lowered to the ground and it came over to me like I was its master. When it lowered its head, I knew it was offering itself as a mount. So we tossed you over the back of it like a saddlebag, and it took us back to the Raven with breathtaking speed. It was beautiful.
Wow.
Don't tell me you believe a word of that carking nonsense. When you hit the tree, Al screamed like a Minoc and almost left you for lizard kibble. Then I stepped in as a voice of courage and reason and lifted you with one arm out of the mud and encouraged Al to be brave, and I led us through the unnavigable treachery of the swamp and back to our beloved home, this here Raven 5.
That is not what happened at all, you crazy bucket of bolts.
Okay. You both are Jedi Knights in shining plasteel. Thank you for saving my hide. In true dramatic fashion, apparently. How long was I out for?
About 15 hours.
Yeah, CB and I both figured it was probably best to just let you sleep it off as long as you could after such a huge concussion. Wait, are you supposed to stay awake? I can't remember, but hey, at least you're still in one piece, bud.
That I am, but while I was out, I kept having a really weird dream of this moon. Maybe a moon of Dagobah? It was above a green planet, but the moon was different somehow. Terrifying.
Quite the bonk on the head.
That is strange. I mean, was it an unusually vivid dream, like a vision of some sort?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, you know, I've had that before, rarely. But they're from the Force, you know, I'd bet my life on it. I wonder if it's from...
From what?
From one of these. I've been collecting shards of kyber crystals wherever we make port. Sometimes I've even felt them and found myself drawn to where they are. I mean, this isn't big enough for a lightsaber, but it was most likely part of one of them, or...
What else did they use these for?
Well, this one here came from Endor a while back, and... Oh my word, it all makes sense now!
It does?
Michael, the vision you've been having... That's no moon. The second Death Star was destroyed just above the forest moon of Endor, and you know what powered its laser?
No.
Kyber crystals!
Wow!
Dude, sit down. We need to document all of this and share some history. Okay, CB, fire it up and hit it.
Transmitter is up in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of The Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast where we explore every corner of the Star Wars galaxy, one topic at a time. I'm Alex Stewart.
And I'm Michael Howarth. And today we are talking about the Death Star, the greatest superweapon in the galaxy. Yes, indeed. Al, are you ready to get down on this ultimate battle station?
I was born to get down to clown on the ultimate killing weapon.
down to clown.
Fully
we can't
operational
talk about
battle station. Battle station.
We can't start talking about clowns again. If anybody listened to that last episode, Al went off about clowning.
Don't get me started. Don't get me started.
Oh, dude, I had this Christmas ornament. You know the Hallmark ones you plug in?
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then they
Did they like hold down the entire half of the tree?
Yep. Exactly. Yeah, I had this Death Star 2 one that would do that. And my mom had it set up so you'd plug in all of them at once because it was like a Christmas light strand and they'd all turn on at the same time. And it was just cacophony, pure chaos. And the one that stood out is like all of them would be done running like the trains and the Santa songs. And then it would be Palpatine and be like,
witness the firepower of this fully operational battle station. Commander, fire at will.
It lasted like 5 minutes.
That's amazing.
Yes, it was so good.
I've always wanted those, but first and foremost, they're like $79
yeah,
per ornament.
Very expensive, yeah.
And I just look at them and I'm like, that would just weigh the entire tree down. Like it would break a branch off of a Douglas fir.
Yeah, it was set up kind of like a Christmas village. It was its own display of all the Hallmark like animated ones.
Is your mom a bit of a village aficionado?
She is a Christmas aficionado. You should see her house. Like, you ever go to a department store around Christmas and the trees just look like just insanity, like Santa Claus himself threw up all over it? That's what my mom's house looks like. Like, I looked this year, I was over there, and I looked inside her fake Christmas tree, and there were ornaments in it, like inside
That's
of it.
That's awesome.
I can't believe this.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it gets over the top there. Lots of garland.
Your mom and I share one spirit, I think.
The decorating spirit.
That's incredible. Speaking of the decorating spirit, we need to talk about the moon that decorated the skies above the doomed planets as it took them out one by one. We need to talk about the Death Star, Michael.
Absolutely. In all its glory. Yes. Okay, let's get into it. So first up, I want to thank the YouTube channel Star Wars Explained, which if you are not familiar, it
is
fantastic. They do incredible breakdowns of every single topic you can think of in Star Wars. They're very popular. I used two of their videos about the Death Star as my primary source of notes for this. So a lot of the stuff here comes from them. So it's enough that I was writing things down and I'm like, I need to call that out because that was very beneficial.
Good call. Thanks, Star Wars Explained.
Yeah, thank you guys. That was very helpful. But Al and I will bring our own random tidbits to talk about Christmas ornaments as well. So, So Al, I figured we'd start this off because you like to talk about story value. In our last episode, you know, we always talk about the hero's journey, the, like arcs and tales, things like that. So, what is, in your perspective, the story value of bringing in an indestructible planet-killing super weapon to the Star Wars universe?
You know, I think that's actually a really good question, and it's always hard when we don't get primed with these questions to start because I don't have a super thoughtful answer, but I will
I want
also
you raw.
Say, I do think that there is some interesting a couple of pieces of value out of this. One, we've got something that feels insurmountable. That it's the mountain that needs to be climbed by the hero. It's the ultimate confrontation that takes on a physical embodiment. Because, I mean, if you think about it, the Death Star almost in a lot of ways is metaphorical for Darth Vader in the life and the struggle of Luke Skywalker. Because Luke Skywalker isn't necessarily obsessed with the destruction of the Death Star. But when you think about it, it represents the darkest parts and the most powerful parts of Darth Vader, but it has this extremely simple vulnerability to it. And that perfectly embodies the vulnerability of Darth Vader, that he's extremely powerful, he's extremely daunting, and he's very unforgiving. I mean, he's just cruel. He's a cruel character in Star Wars. But it's a single vulnerability, which is that love and that hope that Luke Skywalker has and that he still has good in him that eventually takes down this powerhouse of destruction. So I think that that's one of the lines of importance for the Death Star. But I think
that's good. I didn't see that coming. I love that.
Well, I'm glad that I aim to please, and sometimes every once in a while...
You delivered.
I hit at least somewhere close to a target.
Yes.
But I think that the second piece of importance that comes from this is the Titanic importance. Mm. That the builders of the Titanic believed that it was unsinkable. And yeah. So you see this hubris that was created by these builders of these titans back in the day. And mm-hmm. that's exactly what we mirror with the Death Star, that we bring some humanity into and some humility in the humanity of the Empire, in that yeah. they are putting all of this, the witnessing the full power of this fully operational battle station.
Yeah.
And we see how easily destroying, or I should say how easily destroyed planets are by it. But mm-hmm. when it gets destroyed, it utterly decimates. Because, I mean, think about it from a war perspective. The thing that's hard about the Empire is it doesn't necessarily have a central location from right. which it plans and strategizes. It's splintered in a lot of mm-hmm. ways, and it's ill-defined. And that yeah. was the goal of the Death Star, was it was the centralized point from which...
Unifying.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, from where the powers that be would be able to
yeah.
move the battle forward. And mm-hmm. when that disappeared, it splintered again, not only physically, but and you see this in things like Lost Stars, when you see the periphery of what the explosion of the Death Star represented to the Empire. It mm-hmm. really was the beginning of the end. We're looking yeah. at the beginning of the end of the Empire with the destruction of the Death Star. That's not that's not like the crowning moment that where the battle begins, where the Star Wars begin, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think that we see that as the beginning of the end.
Yeah. Interesting. That's good. That was more of an answer than I was expecting. Thank you, Al.
What were you thinking?
To kick
just
going
to be like, it's a big old ball with a laser on it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. No, I didn't know what you were going to pull out, but I am glad that it was very insightful. That's good. Okay. Well, we're going to circle back to, oh gosh, I hate that I just said that in all seriousness, circle back to, I take it back. I take it all back.
I just want this to be an organic conversation.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to think about shareholder value and, make sure our stakeholders are happy.
Dividends. It's all about dividends.
Dividends. Yeah, exactly. Lizzie, how do the optics look on this? Okay, I'm done. We're going to come back to the in-universe stuff towards the end. But here at the beginning, we're going to start out with behind the scenes, as we always do. So... The Death Star. The original matte painting for the Death Star was done by, fill in the blank, who, Al?
Ralph McQuarrie.
Yes, the guy we talk about constantly.
Minchioda.
Ralph McQuarrie did the original matte painting for the Death Star. And this is an interesting one.
I haven't seen this art. I need to look this up
right now. It is
beautiful.
We'll put this in the show notes as well. But this original matte painting, the laser dish, like the radar dish where the laser comes out of, was actually located right in the center of the Death Star along that center line. It's not offset in the upper half like we see in the classic Death Star. But it is a fully fleshed out, fully completed matte painting. And it's really, really pretty, and it has like a different vibe to it. And it's kind of funny because you can actually see that this was the original plan for this model, because the 3D rendering, I use 3D lightly there, but in the Rebel briefing room when they're planning their attack on the Death Star, and they're talking about how there's a ventilation shaft that a small fighter could get to, and they're talking about, you know, bullseye womp rats back home that are no less than 2 meters wide, that whole 3D animatic thing, mm-hmm. it shows the radar dish in the center line of the Death Star. So they had done that 3D animation before... Ooh. They shifted the idea of moving it kind of off center so that the laser comes out of the top half of it, which I thought was kind of interesting.
That's fascinating. I'm trying to find yeah. the original artwork for this, but for some reason I am not finding the original art piece for this.
It takes a little digging, but I did see it earlier today, and I will definitely be sharing that in the notes. Because, yeah, it's a cool piece, because it's not like a pencil sketch. It's a fully done matte painting. And for anybody who isn't familiar or hasn't listened to other episodes, the matte paintings are basically done on panes of glass, and then they are shot with a camera. And a lot of the planet scenes that you see whenever you're coming over Yavin or you're coming over Endor, the planets you see as the ships are flying by are just flat paintings that are done, and they're just very realistic and amazing pieces of art. So that was the original plan for the Death Star. And once we get to actually building the model, go ahead.
Well, and one question that I had for you is, do you know why Lucas chose a planet killer like this? Is there any reason why? Because, I mean, obviously, I waxed poetic about why I believe it's important. But, I mean, obviously, there are a lot of other things that Lucas could have chosen as far as kind of that axiom of danger and terror. Why a planet-destroying moon?
Yeah, so I do have some thoughts on this, and let's just jump ahead. We can skip over this note once we get there. But my thinking on it is that there's a lot of World War II in the inspirations for Star Wars, right? And there's kind of this. Sometimes the things that are inspired by, you know, obviously Germany had a huge inspiration on the Empire, and the Nazis had an inspiration on the Imperial outfits, things like that. But then there's a lot of America in the Empire as well. So it's more of a criticism of large political powers, not necessarily just Germany and not necessarily a one-to-one with World War II. So my thinking is that the Death Star really represents the nuclear bomb, like the nuclear bomb that was developed by Oppenheimer that they dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is like the Alderaan is the Hiroshima, as a way to use oppression and fear to get peace out of a world, which was the original goal of the atomic bomb. And strangely, kind of worked in the real world where there is kind of a peace by fear. And I think that's kind of where that came from, knowing that he had a big World War II inspiration.
The difference is, do you think that they planned on using it more? Because I don't think that they were just doing it to show that they could. I think that they had every intention on destroying multiple planets in the system. At least that's the indication of conversations, right?
I think they would have, but when you think about the scale of the galaxy and the population of the galaxy, that would be comparable to just destroying two cities. So there was actually this thing called the Tarkin Doctrine. This is a little bit in-universe, but the Tarkin Doctrine in Star Wars was that Grand Moff Tarkin believed that the fear of annihilation would keep the galaxy under control and at peace. And there were people
mutually assured destruction is what we call that in the real world.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But then we have figures like Grand Admiral Thrawn, who believed he saw the hubris in that, and he believed that they needed to keep their entire fleet separate, and that's why he was investing Imperial resources into the TIE fighters he was building. And this is a whole storyline in Rebels where the Rebels are trying to destroy one of the factories where they're building these new TIE interceptors. I forgot, they're like the Tri-Wing ones. That's not the name of them. I can't remember. But they were TIE bombers or TIE interceptors with shields.
Wait, do you know why do you know why those didn't move forward? Like why those TIE interceptors didn't move forward? Because it's do or do not. There is no TIE.
Sorry.
Goodness.
I had to just totally cut you off before that
too
went
much.
Too far.
No, that's good. I was spiraling anyway. But yeah, so there were other Imperials that had different opinions, and there was also like the dude in A New Hope who's like, you're overly confident in this technological terror you've created, Lord Vader. So he was a big proponent of Star Destroyers. He wanted a massive Star Destroyer fleet, and he did not want to do the Death Star. So there was difference in opinion within the Empire as to whether or not building a singular, like, super weapon and base was even a good idea.
But interesting. So I bring up a lot of the stories, I should say story utility, but you bring up this very existential component as to why the Death Star exists. And I could totally see the parallels to the nuclear bomb, that it's overpowered, it's absolutely terrifying, that in nobody's hands is it really good to have that kind of ability to just annihilate an entire planet like that.
Just indiscriminately, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
But to really answer your question, we don't know. If you look at the Wikipedia page for the Death Star, you'd think it would be, you know, 100 pages long, right? It's the Death Star.
Is it very, very scant?
It is extremely short. It's one of the shortest pages on Wikipedia. There is actually not a ton on it. Like, most of the interesting facts are kind of visual dictionary style pieces of information, which we'll get into a bit, but not a ton. Like, not a lot of information.
That's kind of fascinating, because I think that the Death Star, in a lot of ways, is almost the Star Wars version of the MacGuffin. And have we talked about the MacGuffin before?
I've heard you say the word, but I don't remember.
Yeah, so MacGuffin was an old Irishman who sold wonderful alcoholic beverage. No, the MacGuffin is actually a constant.
I was tracking. I was there. I was like, all right,
his
MacGuffin.
His name was Patrick MacGuffin.
Oh, Patrick MacGuffin.
So the MacGuffin is, it's a story, how do I say this? It's a story tool that was created primarily by Alfred Hitchcock. And the MacGuffin was designed as an element in the story that drives the story forward, but generally has nothing to do specifically with the storyline itself. Now, one of the best examples of this is the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. The briefcase in Pulp Fiction is studied in cinema classes across the globe for its MacGuffin characteristics, because when they open the briefcase, something shines on their face, but you never know what's inside that briefcase. But the entire film is hinging on the contents of that briefcase.
Right.
So the entire New Hope is hinged on the destruction of the Death Star, but that's the only purpose that the Death Star has served.
Yeah, to get destroyed. Interesting.
And so I think that that's why there's not a lot known about it. Because, I mean, think about it. Rogue One is all based off of getting these plans for this Death Star, when in reality it has nothing to do with the plot itself other than just getting the plans.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of like the box in Burn After Reading. Like, what's in the box?
That's exactly it. Yes.
That's a MacGuffin.
Yep.
I love that. That's
exactly
good. Yeah, and not to say there isn't a lot of good information about the Death Star, because there is, about kind of where it came from. And every time it shows up, people are like, oh, that's the Death Star, which is epic. But so we'll get into some of that. But yeah, that's to answer your question a little bit. But so let's get back to some of the behind the scenes.
Yeah. Because you were talking about the creation of this thing. And I always think that it's fascinating when you see in the Star Wars universe it going from a Macquarie painting into the real world. What is sacrificed? What remains faithful to the original? So I'm curious what that process looks like.
Yeah, and this is kind of where we landed on the final version of what we see in the film, because of some problems they ran into when they were building the model. So taking this from 2D to 3D was obviously a big undertaking. The model was constructed by Colin Cantwell, who was a model maker who worked on the Y-Wings, the X-Wings, the TIE Fighters, the Death Star, the Star Destroyers. He did everything. It was amazing. And he built this giant orb that was 4 feet wide, and it was made out of a specific kind of plastic that was not very heat resistant, and it had a lot of tendency to
Seems like a
warp.
Great idea.
Yeah, exactly. So it would bend and warp, and they made two halves of it. So they made one half and then the bottom half, and then they were going to bring them together and kind of smooth out those edges so you have this perfect sphere.
What could go wrong?
Yes, at 4 feet wide. So it ended up a little wonky, a little melty, and a little wobbly. So when they built these two halves, they'd put them together, and it was a little bit more like Hamburger Bunny. Like, it kind of stuck out in the middle, a little squashed. Yeah, it wasn't perfect. So it was really difficult for them to make it look like a perfect seamless sphere. Uh-huh. So Colin Cantwell talked to Lucas and said, hey, like, how about instead of trying to make this perfect, we put a trench in the middle, like a meridional trench where the two halves meet, and then we can kind of highlight the imperfection rather than try to hide it, which would have come across more obvious. So Lucas liked the idea. He said, cool, let's go ahead and do that. But that necessitated that they move the radar dish from the center point where it crosses that line up to the top hemisphere of the Death Star itself. So that's actually why the laser is not centered and that it comes out of the top part of it. It was because of a model making problem they ran into.
But I think I would argue that it looks way cooler that way.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, like symmetry is good for certain things, but asymmetry adds a lot more visual interest, I think, to the look of the Death Star, for sure. But kind of coming back to what you were talking about earlier, yes, the I think some of the inspiration came from Flash Gordon as well, because there's always, you know, the big bad thing that they're trying to destroy, and there's so much Flash Gordon in this that if I remember correctly, I do think there is something similar in Flash Gordon at one point, which is probably where some of the inspiration for this came from. And also, so speaking of the trench, the trench run is very inspired by a World War II film, The Dam Busters, which is an aerial dogfight adventure World War II movie about these American pilots that are flying in and trying to destroy this dam so that they could gain some kind of tactical advantage. I don't remember exactly what happens in the plot, but there's a lot of parts to it where they even have a briefing room where they're looking at, you know, sketching out where they need to fly and how they're going to drop a bomb perfectly into this one little tiny spot that will then destroy the entire dam.
That's crazy.
And it'll run down. Yeah, they actually even reused some of the same exact lines of dialogue from the end of that movie in A New Hope. So it was very inspired by the
Dam
Busters.
No way.
Yeah. And funny enough, a dude, Gilbert Taylor, worked on Star Wars and the Dam Busters. So he actually worked on both. On the
Talk
crew.
About full circle.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's so incredible.
Yeah, I know. I know. I thought that was awesome. And there was another World War II movie that they used for some of the dogfight references as well. But.
Well, and one of the things that I think is really interesting about the Death Star in general is you have to have different scales with the Death Star, because obviously with a ship design, you're using very similar models, if not the exact same model, for all of the pieces that you're shooting. Whereas with the Death Star, with the scale being so large, you not only have to create the wide shot model of it, but you also have to be shooting or creating models for the dogfights that are above the surface of the Death Star, as well as the trench run scenes. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing to see all these different pieces that have to come together with that. And so I'm curious if what the nuts and bolts of that looked like, taking it from the large scale into these smaller chunks like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great transition. So they did build, obviously they have the map painting, they have the full size 4-foot orb, and then they had to build the surface of it, which was really, you know, you're up close on this moon sized surface. So it's basically just a flat panel that you're like flying across once we see the X-Wings get really close to it. And when they did that, they built this giant 60-foot set that had all of these little tiles built into it that made up the surface of the Death Star. And they made like 6 or 7 different molds for them, and then they would rotate them in different positions, and so they could lay out kind of this Tetris tile of what the surface of the Death Star would look like. And they needed it to be modular because they were doing so much pyrotechnics on this. There were so many explosions going off, so they would destroy tiles every time they did an explosion when something, you know, a turret got destroyed or an X-Wing crashed into it, and then they'd have to pull. They could take that tile out and then replace it with another identical one. So they could keep continuity while still destroying parts of it with the pyrotechnics, which was interesting. But this set was huge. It was massive. So they couldn't even build it inside. Like, thinking about the budget, like, this is ILM and they couldn't even build it inside. So they went to the parking lot outside of ILM.
As one does.
Yes, one does. Yep. And built a 60-foot set that was elevated about 4 feet off the ground, where the surface of the Death Star lay. And they did the pyrotechnics out there. And when they did the actual shot of the trench run, they put a camera in an old pickup truck and they had it rigged up on there in the most janky fashion possible. And they would drive the pickup truck past the set like really fast. So the camera is like swinging past this thing so they could get those flyby shots that felt like you were in an X-Wing, like going like over the surface of the Death Star extremely fast.
So I'm curious, did they shoot these at night? Like, were these dogfight scenes shot at night? How did that work?
It was totally in the daylight. They would always shoot this in the daytime. And also, to be fair, I see what you're asking, because obviously there's like the composition they have to do at the end where they're putting together the special effects shots. But there's a lot of scenes where you're kind of first person, like flying into the Death Star and just like kind of drifting over the surface of it.
Uh-huh.
And those were mostly just those camera shots and like the shot on the truck where they're driving past. So they didn't quite have as much, because like the Death Star takes up the full frame, so they didn't have to do as much composition afterwards where they're putting in the space and they're putting in TIE fighters and things like that.
But there's really the lighting is, I guess, what I'm thinking of is it's incredible, because what I was going to say is in the production, what I love so much about the surface of the Death Star is it's reflective exactly like our moon. That it's almost identically colored to our moon, and the reflective nature of that gives it very, very much a 2001 A Space Odyssey feel to the lighting in those scenes. And you can tell that George Lucas was absolutely watching Kubrick from 9 years previous to see exactly how he should be lighting those scenes. And that's where I'm fascinated, because the sun, though it is the largest light bulb we can deal with, it's the most uncontrollable.
Exactly.
And so that's what I find fascinating, is that he had no issues shooting that in the daytime and still being able to get the lighting composition and saturation that he did. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I actually don't know how they did that. I don't know how they got it to look so good.
I don't either.
Because it does.
Now.
It has that exterior planet feel, and it doesn't shift very much. And I mean, I guess there's a lot of movement going on, but pretty amazing. Yeah, I don't even know the answer to all of that as to like how they made that work so well. But it's funny you bring up 2001 as well, because that was the first movie that used a moving camera. Like if you look at special effects shots at films from pre, you know, 1970, almost all special effects shots are a stationary camera where the, you know, the flying saucers or whatever it may be is then moving in the frame, but the camera doesn't move, because that presents an extreme problem for the compositing.
Yes.
I used the wrong word. I said composition before, but when you're compositing,
which
you basically have to
explain what compositing is to folks who may not know that term.
So this is something that comes in with matte paintings as well. So let's say, for example, you're shooting a shot of a person on a beach, but then you want it to look like there's a giant ship that's crashed next to them. So what they would do is they would figure out what that miniature of the ship looks like, and they would figure out the angle that they're shooting at and get everything set up and then place the camera on a tripod or whatever. And they take another pane of glass and basically paint out the area that would be getting exposed on the film to show the ship. And what you're doing is you're not exposing that part of the film. You're only exposing the part of the film that's shooting the person walking on the beach or whatever. So you shoot that shot, and then you have all this film that has a portion of it that is unexposed.
So basically it's see-through. It's clear. It's transparent.
Yes, and it's ready to accept an image again. So you take the same film and you run it through the camera again, but this time you don't have that black there and you have everything else blacked out, and you're just showing that miniature lined up perfectly with where you had the live action shot, and then you film it again. And this is how they did a lot of Ray Harryhausen stuff back in the day, all those old movies, you know, Jason and the Argonauts, et cetera. Yeah.
Well, and so it's fascinating because the earliest iterations of film, when you look at George Méliès is known for being the father of special effects, and even he, as early as 1902, was actually performing composite filming at the age when the Lumiere brothers were still just showing moving trains in a tent at circuses. And Méliès was like, well, I can play with this film a little bit better. So compositing is an extremely, extremely old art. So sorry, I didn't mean to make us digress, but I do think that it's fascinating to see, again, when we're talking behind the scenes, we kind of have to necessarily see that whole picture of the history behind compositing, knowing that it's an old art, but even in that 67 year period, they couldn't really make it so movement in the frame was complementary to what they were doing with compositing. So with
that, exactly.
Enter 2001.
I think that's really, I think it's an important piece to touch, or at least a fun part to talk about when we're talking about the Death Star and this stuff, because that's what gives Star Wars its such a unique feel, especially in 1977. If you watch it now and you've never seen Star Wars before, you would never look at these special effects scenes and understand what felt so different about it, because there is so much motion happening in all of these shots.
Yes.
And I don't know if my description of how the compositing works in the past was super clear, but basically it hinges on the fact that the camera does not move, because you know exactly mapping where everything is going to be in the frame. So when you bring in movement, this is where John Dykstra changed everything at ILM, because John Dykstra invented a repeatable pattern. You could move a camera over and over again, and you knew every frame would be identical to where it was in the previous pass. And this was like mind-blowing at the
That's
time.
That's fascinating. So,
yeah, it was called the Dykstraflex camera. And he and ILM put this together and invented it, basically. And they machined it and put the whole thing together. It was computer-guided, even in 77, 76.
Wow.
So then you're doing the same idea. So you can mat out certain parts of the frame or shoot against a green screen or a blue screen. And they even used those back then. I mean, in the original Star Wars, blue screens were used, which is might be surprising for some, but they could use that to then chroma key that color out to then put in another shot of space or a planet or a backdrop. But it's only possible because every pass of the camera was on the same exact track because of John Dykstra. Like, he changed everything with that.
That's incredible. So for young people and folks who may just, we kind of take it for granted, it's really important to understand how films like Star Wars actually changed the art of cinema. That it wasn't just some sort of pop culture-y thing. But realistically, I was just talking with my students this week about the history of rock and roll, but what the way that we kind of digressed, or I should say the way that we contextualize that, is talking about Michael Jordan versus LeBron James. And the kids, when I was able to say that, it was perfectly understandable to them that you, without Michael Jordan, there could be no LeBron James. So there's no way to compare those two, because LeBron is necessarily tied to the genius behind what Michael Jordan innovated in the sport of basketball. And with modern cinema and visual entertainment, we cannot separate what Lucas and these masterminds of industry did during these cinematic moments where they absolutely changed the way that the art form was produced. I mean, this is basically looking at the invention of a new type of paintbrush. And,
exactly.
And with that, it changes the world.
Yeah, totally. It absolutely does. We're all standing on the shoulders of giants, especially creators and people in artistic endeavors, for sure.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
it was
awesome.
Big. And the reason that 2001 jogged my memory was because 2001 A Space Odyssey was the only science fiction movie up to that point that had ever used a moving camera and motion in those special effects shots. So Kubrick did it before as well, at a much simpler and more realistic scale, where, you know, it was a small movement, like with the space station. So it wasn't crazy, but it was still unique at the time and adds a lot to the realism. And then Star Wars just cranked it to 100 with the action.
Without it, and it requires so much precision in your shooting when you're doing that. And so it makes sense why Kubrick was able to do it on was constrained to do it on such a small scale.
Right.
The way that you see that space station spinning during that open ballet sequence, which is gorgeous.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. And Kubrick was an absolute madman, though. Like, he would do hundreds of takes at a time. So that would have been a nightmare with Star Wars.
Yes. Oh, it wouldn't be possible.
Oh,
it would
my
not
goodness.
Be possible. So with this, another thing that we see is not only do we have these iconic dogfights going on the surface, but the biggest thing that I would say is kind of cemented into pop culture is the final demise of the Death Star, which is that explosion scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's something that's awesome about the way that scene looks on screen. And so I'm curious if there's like some sort of magic behind, I mean, obviously with this Dykstra method, so on and so forth, there's got to be something that they used in order to create almost like a three-dimensional effect with that explosion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know it's funny, we're already at the destruction of the Death Star here. So as you can tell, you know, there's information, there's a lot to learn out there, but it's not you know, as much as you'd expect. But
yeah,
yeah, for the explosion, and this is the other thing ILM does so well, is that they create complex things that are amazing when they need to, but they're always reaching for the simplest solution first, which is part of the reason, that's part of their genius, really.
For sure.
Is that they're not over-engineering things. So the destruction of the Death Star, they had the camera facing up. So the camera was down on the ground,
okay,
and they had a big pane of plexiglass over it to protect it. And then the Death Star was hanging above it, and they had a ton of pyrotechnics inside of it, and they just blew it up like above the camera. And one of the reasons that helped is if the camera was horizontal to the Death Star, as soon as it's destroyed, everything's falling down, right?
Yes.
So it totally breaks the illusion that we are in a gravity-free space where the Death Star would explode into a million pieces. So by putting the camera below it, it looked a lot more realistic that you see those pieces spread in every direction because they're coming towards the camera, which was a really
brilliant,
a really good idea. Yeah. And they layered in fireballs, and they did that kind of...
The ring
that expands out, which is a certain type of explosion that I'm not remembering the name of right now, but they composited all that together, looked fantastic. Those are multiple
explosions layered on top of each other. It's not just one single.
No, yeah, most of the practical part. Oh, it does. Yeah, the practical part that actually destroyed the model, I don't think had a lot of visual like flame that came out. Like you would just see the parts of the Death Star kind of flying apart, and then they had to do other explosions and add those in, like mixing them all together. So there were three or four, maybe even more layers that were added in there, which is pretty amazing. And it ends up looking really good. And like the kind of the firework sparkler sparks that come out.
Yes,
like that
the zingles,
in slow motion.
The little spindles.
The zingles that come out. Like that is so closely linked to the John Williams music that plays in that scene in my mind. Like I can't imagine the Death Star explosion without the score playing over it, which just like adds such an element of just whimsical like joy and magic to the whole thing. It's great.
I think what's so great about that moment is it really is the ultimate victory that occurs. And here's, and we may talk about this later on down the line, but one of the things that I think is detrimental to the original Star Wars trilogy is the fact that the Death Star was revealed in the first of the three films.
Right.
Obviously, Lucas had no clue that this was going to be able to be built out to a third, mm-hmm, or to a second and third film. Because he definitely shot for the moon, literally, yeah, on this. Because you can't go bigger than the Death Star. It's not
right.
possible to go bigger than the Death Star. And the
yep.
sequel trilogy proved that as well. That there
yeah,
is
even
no
something
way.
Literally bigger than has much less weight.
And it's just
in
iterative
the story.
At that point.
Right.
It's iterative.
And derivative.
So, and I mean, if you think about it, it's like, going back to your nuclear explosions and your nuclear bomb metaphor, mm-hmm, that the second nuclear bomb and the larger nuclear bombs that went off subsequently after the first one were not mm-hmm nearly the same impact that the first atomic
right.
bomb had.
Even though they're more dangerous. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so
yeah,
ahead.
I think I just to finish that thought, I do think that it did a bit of a disservice to the story arc for the Death Star to be destroyed in the first. Had they had the long
yeah.
game, I think it would have served the story for them not to bring the Death Star to, because you can even tell that Lucas in his mind was like, well, where do I go bigger now? I can't.
Yeah, exactly. Just the second one.
Exactly.
Three quarters bigger.
Yes. And let's just make it a little bigger and make it under construction and we'll be good.
Yep. Oh, but, man, I do love Death Star 2, though.
It is cool, but at the same time, it's been done. It's just
yeah,
been done.
That's true.
As
that's
the bare naked ladies say, it's all been done. A woo hoo hoo.
Exactly. Prescient.
I have always been looking to include a BNL reference.
I think you have before. I don't think this is your first time.
It's been 1 week.
Oh, man. There's another one.
I just
Ooh,
had
loving
to chickadee China,
goodness.
The Chinese chicken.
Yep. So Al, yeah, any other thoughts or tidbits on the behind the scenes of it? Because yeah, it's a little bit of a short one. I have some other nuggets to talk about.
I'd love for us to talk about some nugs
before we get into in universe. There's actually a lot more in universe for this than there is behind the scenes. But
yeah,
some little Easter eggs they kind of threw in there. So Leia's cell that she is in, which is the cell block for political prisoners, is cell 2187, which
Ooh.
That number might ring a bell because of FN-2187, which is Finn's number as a stormtrooper
in
The Force Awakens.
I love that reference.
Just kind of an awesome callback. So this is also related to behind the scenes a little bit, but the second Death Star cost the same amount as George Lucas's car at the time, which was a Dino Ferrari. And
wow.
That car now, I don't know at the time how much it would have cost, but nowadays it costs $400,000-ish to buy one of those. But it is a retro car now as well.
But still, like, with the second Death Star, and they just blew it up.
And they blew that one up as well, yes. But, well,
I wonder if that model stayed. Like,
I think the model survived, actually. Because
I
believe
where that model
still
is today.
I think it's at the Skywalker Ranch. I'm pretty sure they have it in the archives.
That's how big do you think those archives are?
Dude, unbelievably massive. I would love to walk those hallowed halls. That would be so cool.
You know what sucks?
Incredible.
Is it just takes one match. That's all
what
it
do you
takes.
Mean? Oh, one match to burn it down.
For
dude,
all
seriously.
Of the history to go away. That's terrifying.
Yeah. So Aardman Animation, who did Wallace and Gromit and like a bunch of other of those claymation animated
Chicken
series,
Run.
Chicken Run, absolutely. They lost one of their warehouses that had like 70% of their stuff in it, like in a fire. They did lose all, and then we're talking claymation. There's no coming back from that.
Oh, it just melted. Oh,
I know. Oh, God.
Nothing
that's such
but
a
goop.
Huge bummer to lose all that art. Yeah, it was. It's funny. A bunch of the matte painting artists were really trying to convince George Lucas, and honestly, the model makers were trying to convince George Lucas that they could do it with matte paintings, all the shots of Death Star 2. They were trying to avoid building a physical miniature.
It's intricate. Holy cow,
yeah,
it's intricate.
They didn't want to build it, and they were trying to get away. So one of the guys came to him and said, hey, like, you know, we could do this with matte paintings. We don't know if we need to do a model. And George Lucas asked him, like, how much would it cost? Like, how much does it cost to build this model, this 5 foot wide? This one was a foot larger than the Death Star 1. And he asked him how much it would be. And he said he knew exactly how much he paid for the Ferrari. So he just told him it would be the same cost as the Ferrari, thinking that that would be an outrageous number. George Lucas was like, what? Like, that's all? Go build it. Like, let's do it.
It's like the ultimate backfire, like everybody
yeah,
trying to convince
exactly.
the boss to let them have a snow day yep. when he's just like, well, just each of you buy a sled.
Exactly.
Charge it to me, buy a sled and come on in.
Yep. Which I do think added a ton to the final shot, because it you see it rotating and you see it kind of opening its like under construction maw. Like it's
oh,
so
yeah.
much more visceral that way.
I think
the
that's what I like
great,
about
but
it is it's primordial. I think that's
is,
what I
yeah.
appreciate about the view of
oh, yeah.
the Death Star 2 is that it's not pretty. It's definitely
oh, yeah.
it's in its stage of becoming. Which
exactly.
is what's so great about it.
But it is also fully operational, which is sick. Cool. Yeah. Okay. One last bit. So there is an actual moon. Have you read about this? About
no.
the moon?
Wait.
Mimas?
Mimak? Mimak? No. Mimus. Tell me about this moon.
Mimas? Mimas? So
Mimus.
The
Gallimimus.
So in the real world, in real life, NASA sent out a spacecraft called the Voyager, which was going past Saturn, and it was taking pictures and gathering data, and it found one of the moons of Saturn, which is named Mimas, M-I-M-A-S, looks exactly like the Death Star. It's so
what?
Cool. It has a crater in it in the upper right that like looks just like the Death Star laser. And the moon Mimas is 250 miles wide and the Death Star is 120 miles across. So
wow.
it's about twice as big as the Death Star.
But, wow, that's incredible.
You know,
when was this? I'm assuming this was discovered after
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Star Wars.
Yeah. This was like the two. I mean, this might have only been 10 years ago. I don't remember. But
you know
yeah,
what?
They found
missed
it.
Opportunity, NASA. Why didn't you just name it Death Star?
Seriously,
three
DS1 at least. You know,
I think it needs to be DS3.
So sick. Oh, DS3. Yeah, exactly.
William Herschel, whoever you are definitely not a Star
William
Wars.
Oh, wait. Herschel.
Wait.
What?
Michael, William Herschel, the guy who discovered this moon, died in 1822. So clearly this had to have been discovered before the Death Star.
Well,
before Star Wars.
Okay. I think he saw a little light, a little dot, a speck in the sky. But we got real pictures of it from this Voyager spacecraft where we found out it looks like the Death Star.
Okay, well, you know, it sounds like we're kind of splitting hairs right now.
Hey, look, all right. Cool factoid, that's all. There's a moon in the world that looks like the Death Star, that's all.
It is really awesome. When you look at it, it does almost look like we could be on the verge of
destruction.
Of utter destruction. And yeah it's decimating. So one thing that I want to talk about in our waning moments of this podcast, did you get that moon reference? Waning.
Oh, very nice.
I do what I can. And then when I don't get credit for it, do you notice how I pointed out to try to get credit?
Oh, that's true. You do.
That a true pun aficionado would just let it go by and let people be like, oh, clever, well done. But
you
nope,
need to be seen.
I absolutely need validation. Michael, do you validate?
I validate.
That's what I'm going to ask people whenever I say a joke that doesn't hit. I'm going to ask and say, hey, do you validate?
My gosh.
And then circle back to the joke. So talk us through the in-universe construction of the Death Star. Because in kind of a cool way, the whole Skywalker saga, in a lot of ways, kind of, at least episodes 1 through 6, also kind of mirrors and, I should say, aligns itself with the creation of the Death Star, right?
Yeah. It was happening for a long time. So, like you said, you know, we're getting towards the end here. So I'm gonna go through some of these. Some of it's a little dry. It's kind of a timeline. So I'm just gonna go through this, and then we can talk about some of these points after. But the Death Star was designed by the Geonosians, who were those insect-like creatures that we meet in Episode 2, where the big arena battle happens.
That was my impression of a Geonosian.
What was it? lots of clicking and clacking. There was actually a Geonosian named Click-Clack in Star Wars Rebels. Anybody who's watched.
And that was a weird episode. Click-Clack.
I was scared.
Dude,
Geonosian.
It was awesome. Get out of here. You guys love
Raspberry. Raspberry.
Okay. Designed by the Geonosians as a weapon to use against the Republic during the Clone Wars.
Wow.
So it began its construction pretty much coinciding with the beginning of the Clone Wars. So
it was
going to
be used by the Separatists against the Republic.
Yes. So the Separatists were going to be using the Death Star as a weapon against the Republic. And Dooku and Sidious, or Emperor Palpatine, they always planned on taking over this weapon. So they knew about its construction. They were a part of it. And Dooku obviously is playing the side of the Separatists. Sidious is playing the side of the Republic as the Emperor, or as the, you know, not the Emperor as of yet. But they always planned on taking over this. So it was built right over the planet Geonosius. And right after the end of the Clone Wars, they were wiped out. Their entire species was wiped out. They just destroyed the entire planet so that Palpatine and Sidious could take over the project. They basically stole the Death Star from them after they built the framework of it and wiped out their entire civilization so they could never build another one. So just took advantage of their work. And apparently the Geonosians were like a hive mind, like an insectoid hive mind.
Yeah.
And they thrived on building projects, like they thrived on working on things. And I guess in the lore, they would like kill each other over tasks that were satisfying that they wanted to do. And it was just a part of their culture. So it was like this weird kind of like hive mind of just strangeness. But they all get destroyed. They steal the Death Star, basically. And then the Empire is coming about. So after he took over the Death Star project, after the framework was complete, Moff Gergerod was in charge of the project. And he's the guy, he's the "we will double our efforts" guy.
We will double our efforts.
So he was in charge of the project as a whole. Orson Krennic was the director of the Advanced Weapons Research, who is the baddie in white from Rogue One.
Orson Welles directed Citizen Kane.
Yeah, exactly. Which was the super laser project that he was a part of. Yes. But it was also called Project Celestial Power as a code name. And the rest of the Death Star was completed. PCP. Yeah, exactly. That's what they called it.
Will you be... are you almost finished cooking the PCP?
They're like, it will be operational. So the Death Star itself was completed. The rest of it was completed by Wookiees and other slaves in dispersed parts of the galaxy. So they had all these different groups building sections of the Death Star, totally not knowing what they were building, which is something that they expand on in Andor in a fantastic way.
And is very much something that the Nazis would do, too.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. Yeah.
So no one knew what they were working on. And Galen Erso, he was the chief researcher on the project Celestial Power, which was the super laser. But he believed that they were working on it to use kyber crystals as an affordable energy source for developing worlds. So he actually didn't know at all that this was a weapon. He had zero clue that this was being used for a battle station. The reason that
he left
and where we find him at the beginning of Rogue One is because he found out that it was for a weapon and he left. He defected from the Empire the second he found out about that and went and took his family and hid away. And that beginning of Rogue One is Krennic finding him and basically kidnapping him and forcing him to come back to the project to finish it because it was delayed by years and years and years because they needed him to actually complete the kyber crystal driven super laser.
So to follow then, through with the metaphor, he was essentially the Oppenheimer of of this base.
Totally. 1,000%. Yeah. I didn't even think about that, but yeah, he was very inspired by Oppenheimer. So he comes back knowing that someone else is going to do it anyway and that it's going to be done. So then he's the one who builds the thermal exhaust port as a defect into it that could be then exploited by Luke Skywalker later on.
Which is a brilliant retcon. That's a brilliant retcon that they did.
It's my favorite retcon. Totally.
I think it's
because
I think it works so well. There's a lot of these where it feels like, oh, well, that piece is a little jagged. Let's shave it and make it work.
Yeah.
Whereas that one, it's like it solved every gripe that every internet troll ever had, which is like, well, I want to see exhaust port. That doesn't make any sense.
Yep. Yep.
And then in 2015, they come out and they're like, oh, but it does. Boom.
Exactly.
And then they drop the proverbial celestial power mic.
Celestial power. Yep. And I love that it's called celestial power because that makes sense why he would believe it was a part of a affordable energy project. Celestial power. But it was actually a weapon. So, so he comes back. There is a really cool episode in Star Wars Rebels that's a heist for one of the large kyber crystals that powers the laser in the Death Star with Saw Gerrera as well. That's really cool. And they got these crystals from old Jedi temples like Jeddah and Ilum, and then would transport them to the Death Star. So those giant cargo ships you see in Rogue One landing in Jeddah, those are trying to pick up loads of kyber crystal, basically.
And then when we fast forward and have an episode about Starkiller Base, that's when we realize that Starkiller Base is actually the planet Jeddah, which is
Ilum.
Which is still so very full circle. In this kyber mining process, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Dude, that's one of the coolest things about, that is the coolest thing about Starkiller Base. And I feel like it would have worked better if they pushed that as part of the story.
Yes. Like, yeah, exactly. If they would have tied that in, it would have, people would have understood it instead of being like, oh, so you're just remaking A New Hope.
Right. Yeah, it was kind of an Easter egg that it even is Ilum.
Yeah.
But if they like drove home the fact that like the First Order was stealing one of the most holy sacred sites of the Jedi where tons of kyber crystals in the galaxy came from and then just totally bastardizing it into a weapon, like that is so much cooler than like just unveiling it and blowing up a bunch of planets.
It's a big planet that kills things.
Yeah.
Though I do love the Starkiller reference. Starkiller is awesome.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely. From The Force Unleashed, definitely cool.
Well, and Starkiller is, well, it's not even from The Force Unleashed.
Oh, right,
it's from
the
original treatment of Star Wars, which then was a reference in Force Unleashed, which was, it's a reference of a reference. It's a reference layer cake, if you will.
Reference Inception, absolutely. Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, take my nerd card. I hand it over.
Michael, I didn't mean to call you out on that, bud. I meant to just, I'm sorry if it felt like I shamed you there. I'm ashamed for feeling like.
I should have remembered. Ugh.
Do
idiot.
Or do not. There is no Ilum.
Yeah, not anymore.
I love that the entire saga is essentially hinging on the creation of this superpower. Again, yeah. With that, I wish that there was the knowledge that there was going to be three, so we could have seen Starkiller, the Death Star 2 actually being the Death Star 1 and them not fully being able to destroy it or something like that.
Right.
So you have this tension growing through Empire and Return of the Jedi to get to that place instead of being like, oh, you can't erase it. Let me come back to it. It's like the Empire is a one-trick pony is what we've all realized.
True. Yeah.
Which, again, I will say this, though. I will say this. Adolf Hitler was a one-trick pony, now that I think about it.
Totally.
So if we are seeing a parallel there with World War II, it's very easy to extrapolate that and say, well, yeah, they were just doing essentially what Adolf Hitler did, and you realize that that's why the Nazi regime started to fail, is because Hitler had one trick and was like, we don't have anything other than the Blitzkrieg. Okay, now what do we do? And it didn't work. So, okay. All right, G. Lucas, I'll give you that one.
Yeah, I agree. And like, I think from a realistic perspective, it makes sense to just iterate on something that already exists. Because, you know, it took 23 years to build the first Death Star in universe. And then it only took them about 3 or 4 years to build the second one, which tracks with already having the technology, knowing how to do it, rebuilding it. So in a real world scenario, it makes a lot of sense, but narratively, it's a little less satisfying. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yep, I agree with that. I agree with that. So where do we go from here, Michael?
Well, there's obviously a lot more we can talk about, but there's a couple little other things that are interesting about the in-universe part of it. So it has, well, I say interesting. I think they're fun, but it has 357 internal levels, and there are 163 levels in the Burj Khalifa in Dubai in the real world. So the tallest building in the world has about half as many levels as the Death Star. But the Death Star is a moon. So there's a lot of negative space in there.
Yes. Yes.
Or high ceilings.
I'm assuming that a lot of it has to do with like propulsion and engines and stuff like that, maybe? I don't know.
Probably, yeah. And the Death Star actually does have a hyperdrive. It's capable of going into hyperspace, which is fascinating.
That's
we never see that.
Ludicrous. I would love
yeah,
to see
ludicrous.
That happen.
Yep. Yeah. It's got elevators that go up and down and side to side, so their turbo lifts can take you anywhere you want, which is kind of cool. And I do think they talk about that in Lost Stars, about the riding the turbo lifts.
Yes,
go
they do.
Horizontal and vertical. Which is kind of cool. There was a bar, which is fun. Bar for the stormtroopers.
Only makes sense.
Yeah.
Stormtrooper bar would be a very cool pop-up.
Oh, yeah. Totally. That would be fantastic. A little tiki. I always want everything to be tiki.
Yeah. You know? Everybody does.
Everything should be tiki. So, Al, why would they... I have a question for you. Why would they have to compact their trash? Why is it beneficial at all to compact trash in the first place in the Death Star?
Well, I mean, there was the clean space initiative that was brought forth by the Gungans back ABY 12, I think, and that they said that you cannot release it unless it's been compacted.
Right. Yeah.
Cannot some release can, of this if it's not in compacting. Release it out of
combat. You get bombat. You could dump it into space. It just has to be a little like cube.
Didn't they see the movie Wall-E? I mean, it's high end.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think that's a great question. Why was it compacted instead of just shot out into space?
Yeah, that's my real. That's the real thinker that I'm left with after this whole thing.
I've never even intellectualized that. First, last week, a couple weeks ago, you hit me with the Watto mind freak that I'm like, man, I didn't even realize that there was this racial problem there in front of me this whole time.
Sorry.
And now
Watto.
I realize that there's no need for compacting the trash other than to feed a creature. I'm also curious how the creature got in there. Is that like a worm? Was that defecated out of somebody and it grew?
So is there is that? That story, thankfully, has been told in its complete entirety.
Oh, all right.
Is, a female Dianoga that was transported from their home planet by accident to the it's told from the Dianoga's perspective, which is very strange. So they don't know why they were picked up, but yeah, they were brought in a tank and then like dumped in there. So they serve some sort of purpose within the trash compactor, but it's in from a certain point of view, the novel.
Okay. Okay. Noted.
Very, very odd, very fun, but very strange little story in there.
I like strange little stories.
Oh yeah, it's good stuff. Well,
yeah. One last question that I have is, I think you need to talk about how many people were on board, because that's important to understand from Lost Stars, which is a book we keep bringing up. And yes, soon enough we will do a novel episode.
Yes,
One of the things that we have to understand is the impact that this had on the Empire when the explosion took place. How many people did Luke Skywalker single-handedly kill?
So the number that I've read is that the Death Star was not completely staffed when it was destroyed. So about 750,000 is the approximate number.
Okay. So he killed about 750K all at once.
Right. But millions died.
How do you think Obi-Wan felt about that one?
You know, I was thinking about that. You think they would feel a disturbance in the Force as Jedi, that voices were silenced, because they're still voices, like individuals in the Force, you know?
Exactly. And just because they're part of the Empire.
Good riddance. I'm a Jedi.
It really does. Like, there needs to be a supercut of that where there's like this, all the families of the Empire, all the families of the stormtroopers, all the families of the engineers, like mourning as Luke Skywalker's driving off into the night, going,
partying.
Yahoo!
Getting a medal. it's really, I had friends on that Death Star. It's classic.
Oh my gosh. Which I think is something that's really important to discuss long term. Is from the perspective of the Empire, what negative feelings what the metaphorical meaning of the explosion of the Death Star had, and how it bolstered some, and then how it disheartened others. If you want to learn more about that, read Lost Stars. If you're going to read one, I think you and I would probably both agree with this. If you're going to read one Star Wars novel and not go any further, Lost Stars is the one to read.
1,000%. It's so fantastic. Yeah, definitely my favorite. Timothy Zahn is still, you know, up there as one of my absolute favorites as well. But you got to read multiple books if you want to get down on some Zahn.
Yeah, I think Claudia Gray masterfully wrote Lost Stars to be a book that if you took out every Star Wars reference, it would still be absolutely spectacular.
Exactly.
As a standalone novel, because it almost feels like Ender's Game in the Star Wars universe to me.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, absolutely. It's just an enthralling story. I was so gripped the whole time. I loved it.
Just a work of art.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good, let's lead out with a recommendation for Lost Stars and praise for Claudia Gray. And so that's the Death Star in a bit of a nutshell. Little Death Star Colin Cantwell nutshell.
Well, thanks for taking us down the proverbial trench on this one, Michael. I feel like we definitely hit every target along the way. And I think that as we fly out, all we can say is, Yahoo! I will never see that scene. Like, I just want to hear dark music behind that.
Yeah, exactly. All the particles.
All right, Michael, take us out. Lead us out of this.
Alrighty. So if you can learn more about this and all of our other episodes at smugglersdispatch.com. CB has put together show notes, links, pictures, and more for you to peruse at your leisure. On Instagram and YouTube as well, you can find us at Smugglers Dispatch. So go follow and check out the show there as well. More content coming in the near future.
Yes.
And hopefully, again, if you are a listener from the future, hopefully it's great. Hopefully it is just a very verdant garden, I would hope. So,
I like this verdant garden. I always want to be described. I want my facial hair to be defined as a verdant garden. Speaking of verdant gardens, folks, we want to hear from you about Michael's verdant garden of facial hair. We would love ratings, and we would love even more reviews on things like Apple Podcasts. And you can even write in on like a Q&A thing on Spotify now. We'd love to see some of your feedback on these episodes. And speaking of feedback, one of the things that we love the most is over on our website that was created by Michael single-handedly. It's his Death Star. Smugglersdispatch.com. If you can find that single exhaust port and you drop a voicemail down into it, it will literally blow up the entire website. Like there's an animation that will blow up the website, which is awesome. So I want you to go onto our website, smugglersdispatch.com. I want you to go down into the bottom corner. Is it the left or the right?
It's on the right.
It's on the right side. There's a little microphone icon, and that's where your target. So you're going to click on that. You're going to leave us a voicemail. We want to hear your thoughts on the Death Star. We want to hear your thoughts on Star Wars. Leave any questions that you may have, any comments, any corrections that you have of information that we may not have gotten correct on the show, anything that you wanted to add. We want to hear from your voice. We want to put that on the podcast because basically Michael and I are tired of talking. We don't want to talk anymore.
Mail. Yeah. We'll put hate mail on
there. Will literally, if you read out of the phone book for 6.5 minutes, we'll just put that up at this point. We're desperate.
Amazing.
So call in and get on the show. We want that. And actually, our next episode is going to be us covering everything we know, literally everything we know about the planet Tatooine. So if you've got thoughts about the planet Tatooine, then please be sure to plug in your thoughts on that little microphone icon. And what I love is now you are all going to be so curious to see if the website actually explodes when you click on that. So now you got no choice but to go over there.
Plant a seed.
So with that, Michael, take us out.
Well, thank you guys for tuning in. May the Force be with you.
And may the stars light your way! Yee-hoo!